But man, that guy, he ripped a lot of comfortable heaters, man. Like, he just take one out. Like, it's crazy, too, because he'd, like, be in the middle of, like, you know, like the NICU at a hospital, you know, because it's, like, 1940, and he's just lighting up in there. I got to get these kids on their, they got to get their humors balanced early.
Welcome back to the Trilateral Troika. This is Steve, along with the other Steve.
Schmitz fights.
And Ryan.
Pour one out for the Knicks. Once again, not making the finals. Another year of not having to see Spike Lee. Spike Lee.
You're pouring one out for our data rights, which of Peter Thiel's transaction is complete. You know, transaction complete. All right, Peter, now you've got the data on everyone in your fucking goddamn company named after the scrying fucking balls in Lord of the Rings.
That drive people crazy.
In 50 words or less, what is Peter Thiel's deal? Like, I know he's a billionaire.
Peter Thiel's actually what Elon Musk would be if Elon Musk was intelligent in any way.
Oh, boy.
So, like, if Elon Musk was actually a smart guy who knew anything about a subject, that would be Peter Thiel. And I think he's worse in a lot of ways because he's a gay dude who was outed by – who outed him, Steve? It was fucked up.
He was outed by Gawker.
Yeah, like, it was Gawker. Like, you remember Gawker Media?
Yeah.
Yeah, they outed him. They didn't have permission.
And then he got back at them by doing the Hulk Hogan sex tape trial.
Yeah, he bankrolled that whole thing.
Wow. Oh, shit, guys, breaking. Live right here on the Trilateral Troika, King of the Hill voice actor Jonathan Joss was shot and killed on Sunday night in San Antonio. He was the voice actor for John Redcorn.
Yeah, I saw that earlier. Yeah, it's sad, too, because he had a lot of issues. Like, he had apparently had a lot of mental health and substance abuse issues.
Yeah.
And that, like, they had a reunion, I think it was Saturday night, and he wasn't invited. He wasn't invited because they couldn't really, like, rely on him to, like be able to, like, be up on stage and do, like, a panel show.
Was he, like, a bad alcoholic or drugs?
I think both. I know at least alcohol, but that was, like, the main reason why they didn't do it, out of, like, concern that, like, if they put him up on stage, he'd do something that would get him all in trouble or something.
Wait, did you guys, I'm so surprised. It's Pride Month. Did you guys see the statement from his husband?
Mm-mm.
Oh, okay. I didn't see it either until about, like, an hour or two ago. Yeah, he was being harassed for being gay, and he was killed because he was gay.
That's right. Really? That's what I hadn't heard anything concrete about it, but it sounded like his neighbor was harassing him, and it might have been because of that or something. And then he ended up getting shot.
It's pretty bad. I've only seen it posted here. I haven't looked yet. Just haven't had time. But yeah, it burned his house.
Yeah, his house burned down in a fire, like last month.
Mm-hmm.
It was recently, but it was like a month. It was like last month or the month before.
Yeah. Damn, that's unfortunate.
He was also the leader of, like, the Native American tribe in Parks and Rec.
Yep.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, I guess he was. Yeah.
Terrible, man. Unbelievable.
Speaking of unbelievable things.
Well, today, boys, we're going to be talking about the life of one Howard Robard Hughes Jr.
Oh, man.
Howard Hughes. Why does that name sound familiar?
He's, like, one of the most famous billionaire, like, names in the 20th century.
Yeah,
he lost his fucking mind.
Well, I mean, that's everybody.
He lost his mind. He's the guy that... Who was in the video? DiCaprio?
Yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio played him in The Aviator.
Yeah, he, like, lost his goddamn mind at some point from OCD, I believe.
Yeah, we're mostly going to talk about him, his personal life. We're not really going to go into like all of like the business stuff he was involved in, because it, like, we could do like, we would be doing like three episodes on Howard Hughes.
Yeah, I don't know. Because do that. Like,
because he owned like RKO Studios at one point, and he was like the only like single owner of a movie studio in like the 1950s, since like the talkie era. Like, no one had been like a principal owner of a film studio.
Wait a minute. He pioneered Randy Morton's signature move.
Yes.
Yes. RKO, yes.
Not only that, he's actually he's Randy's dad.
Yeah. No. Wild. Anyway, I've heard this name before. I've never kind of dove in, as it will, to learning anything about him.
I saw like a documentary on him at some point. I've never seen The Aviator, but that's nothing new for me there.
Yeah, I heard it wasn't bad, but I never saw it.
It's pretty good.
DiCaprio is like hit or miss for me. Like, I think he's a great actor.
Best DiCaprio performance, go.
Best movie, hands down. The Departed.
Oh, my man. My man, okay. All right.
He's fantastic. He's completely believable in that role.
Oh, 100%. 110%.
I mean, he probably has better movies. Like, Inception, you could even go that far. Like, I'd say Inception's a better movie overall.
I was a huge fan of Shutter Island.
Because I thought Nicholson was kind of weak. Even though he was good, I just kind of thought he was getting a little too old for it.
For what, Inception?
No, Nicholson. No. In, The Departed.
Oh, okay.
He's getting a little old.
Yeah, Nicholson wasn't in Inception.
That was going to be my next question. Is yeah, was he?
Yeah, he was in Ryan's Dream.
Oh boy.
Ryan, you gotta get your totem. You have to make sure you're not dreaming.
I'll never find my totem with all the fidget toys I have.
Let me grab my totem over here. It's a scratchy and a pack of mobs.
I always lose.
I got it from Cumberland Farms down the road.
What was I watching recently where every time that guy lit a cigarette, I was just like, man, that looks comfortable.
We were talking about it at work the other day, and I was like, I haven't smoked since like 2010, but yep. Man, every now and then in the morning, I get a craving for when I'm drinking coffee. Oh, I'm like, man, you know what would kill right now?
You want that downer. You need that downer.
Refreshing taste of a Marlboro Mild, aka the Marlboro Blue Pack.
Oh, oof. Nothing like it, bro.
God.
I can't remember what the hell I was watching, though. I'm trying to think. Oh, you know what it was? The Brutalist. Which was...
How was that, Steve?
Honestly, was it brutal? I'll just jump right to that part. I thought it was going to be much worse than, like, the way people described to me. It was bad, but it wasn't, like, graphic or anything. And it was over
in,
like...
Joker too bad?
Yeah, it was over in, like, 15 seconds. Like, Guy Pearce didn't take too many pumps, you know? He was just done, and it was over. And I was like, okay, we're going to the next scene. But, Ryan, if you have to know, it's about someone, a Hungarian guy, and it's fake, but it's at some point in the movie, he definitely receives it from a man without asking. And it's fucked up.
Absolutely brutal.
But I'd say of all the times they put that crap in movies, of all the times I've seen it actually shot, because I feel like that's the problem, right? With like, we don't need to get into a long argument about whether rape is a relevant narrative element. It's not. But like,
it never is.
But in a movie, if you want to imply it, okay, I get that. You want to go that far with it. I think
Shawshank Redemption.
I get it. You're implying it, right? But when you make them act it out, that's what's fucking bad, you know. Like they, that I don't need, I, expect I don't need to see to it, dude. Yeah, I don't need to see it. Imply it if you fucking feel like it's what you need for the character development. But like, fuck off with like animating it or actually putting it in. Like, I don't need to see that, you know.
Yeah,
it's fucking.
It's terrible. Shock value for the sake of shock value. It's all it is.
But I will say this: long movie. And kind of, it was, I thought it was okay. I gave it like a 6. But man, that guy, he ripped a lot of comfortable heaters, man. Like, he just take one out. Like, it's crazy, too, because he'd, like, be in the middle of, like, you know, like the NICU at a hospital, you know, because it's, like, 1940, and he's just lighting up in there. I got to get these kids on their, they got to get their humors bounced early.
There used to be an advertisement that was going around. It's a real advertisement. It was it's an old cigarette ad for Camels, and it was more doctors smoke Camels than any other brand.
Yes.
It was like a doctor with a stethoscope, his little lab coat lighting up. It's just like, Jesus
Christ.
Pretty
soon it's going to be a man can't drive home, have one, two beers, you know?
So, Howard Robart Hughes Jr. is the only child of Alan
Stone. He didn't
even
get started yet. Go ahead.
And Howard R. Hughes Sr., who was a successful inventor and businessman from Missouri. It's my understanding, which I'll get to, but most of like Howard Hughes's money Jr. comes from his father, because his father was, as we'll get to, is kind of like the DeVosses and like these other like whack jobs that come out of like Detroit, like for instance, like Shad Khan, the owner of the Jacksonville Jaguars, like. He made his fortune because he was an engineer and he designed like a part of a car bumper that like every car in the world has to have, like a safety feature. So because of that, he became like a billionaire.
Yeah, it's like hitting the lottery, man. You figure something like that out.
It's like the guy that invented like seatbelts. Like, dude, awesome.
Yeah.
So Howard Hughes himself, he was allegedly a descendant of a John Gano. Who was the minister who allegedly baptized George Washington.
Oh, that's cool.
And John Gano's sister, Susanna, his fifth cousin once removed, makes him a cousin once from fifth cousin once removed of the Wright brothers, Orville and Wilbur.
Oh, Susanna.
Exactly. Howard's father, he patented a two-tone roller bit in 1909, which allowed rotary drilling for petroleum in previously inaccessible places.
So he just invented a new drill bit?
Essentially.
Yeah, big enough to get through, like, you know, your living room so he could get below there and get the oil out.
It just goes straight through houses.
Honey, you better duck. Howard's coming.
He's just driving the drill tank that they had in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
I'm not sitting around here any longer, honey. Howard's right there. He's only going 2 miles an hour, but let's get in the Plymouth and get out of here.
Like the OG Killdozer.
Yeah, freaking Killdozer. What was it? Appetite for Destruction? But in this case, it's Frank Sinatra singing it. Appetite for destruction. Oh, that I've watched the whole goddamn movie once. Or little like clip they put together. It's got to be like 15 minutes.
Yeah, it's pretty long. Hughes' parents made the, or Howard's parents made the decision to commercialize the invention by leasing the bits instead of selling them, which obtained after obtaining several early patents and founding the Hughes Tool Company in 1909. Because one thing is that while you have a trademark on an item, you can charge people royalties on the usage of the item per what they get from it.
Right.
So instead of selling them, they're leasing them and then also, you know, obtaining money that way.
That's a smart way to do business, man. Just lease it to him. Don't actually sell it to him. Lease it to him.
His uncle was a famed novelist and screenwriter and film director named Robert Hughes. In 1941, an affidavit birth certificate of Howard signed by his aunt, Annette Gano Loomis, and by Estelle Botten Sharp, states that he was born on December 24th, 1905 in Harris County, Texas. However, his certificate of baptism recorded it as October 7th, 1906 in the parish register of St. John's Episcopal Church in Keokuk, Iowa, listed his date of birth as September 24th, 1905, without any reference to the place of birth.
God damn, so how many different birthdays does this fucking clown have?
I mean,
I got a brother-in-law like that. Birthday. got a brother-in-law like that. He's got one birthday on Facebook and one birthday in real life. And I'm just like, and it's like, I guess it's like a privacy thing. So I was like, yeah, I respect that. You're just trying to keep it confusing for the bots, right? But
let him know your next move.
But I don't buy him anything for his birthday on fucking principle, you know?
Because you don't know what his fucking birthday is.
Yeah, exactly. Even if I knew what it was, I would not believe that he was telling me the right thing. So he's really got the whole world fooled.
Imagine he calls you and gets mad. You didn't call me on my birthday. I'm like, bro, I don't know where the fuck it is. You change it every year.
You're the unborn. You will not. You will not live to see Christ.
After the neverborn.
Yeah, exactly.
As you as he's like on his deathbed, you've been buying him presents ever since you met him, and then he tells you it's like, that's not my birthday, and then he just expires.
Oh my god. Fucking hell, Steve.
I'm saying like this is like when he's like 90.
No. I'm just saying it's funny as shit, but you really went dark with it. Like, holy, you went like Coen Brothers with it, you know?
He just took the con to the end. He's just
oh,
like,
my God.
Those guys, he's just like, instead of being like fucking with his kids.
All right, Josh, I double it. Like, yeah, I'll tell him. I'll be like, yeah, I double checked. I made sure this was the right birthday. Here's all the gifts I never got you. Instead of, he just looks up at me, just forlorn, and says, that's not my birthday. And then
just like that, you know, instead of those dads or grandparents that tell their children or grandchildren, you know, that they like hit an alien with a Buick Lesabre in 1964. And that they were part of a government conspiracy.
Bro,
if you ever see him, you know, you got right aliens. I hit him so goddamn hard. He got
people are going to think
right in the middle of a stupid little alien forehead. You can tell that's the one I hit.
People are going to think we have a competition this episode, which I'm proposing we start, by the way, to like somehow work references to cars no one fucking dares own anymore. Like, into everything. He said Buick LeSabre. That's fucking good. I used Plymouth earlier. So we got to...
Don't worry about it. I'm going to hit you with a Saturn real quick.
Oh, the SC2? Shaped like half a potato.
The fucking Ion.
Yeah. How about a Daewoo Lanos?
Jesus Christ.
The hatchback's hatchback.
From a young age, Howard showed an interest in science and technology. He had a great engineering aptitude and built Houston's first wireless radio transmitter at age 11. He went on to be one of the first licensed ham radio operators in Houston, having the assigned call sign W5CY, originally 5CY.
What was he, 12?
At 12, he was photographed for the local newspaper, which identified him as the first boy in Houston to have a quote-unquote motorized bicycle, which he had built from parts of his father's steam engine.
Okay, so this guy is not a dumbass.
Nope.
He's actually smart.
No, he's the opposite
of a dumbass.
Yes,
he's incredibly intelligent.
Okay.
No, he's actually, again, Elon Musk. No, I'm just kidding. He's not that bad.
No.
I mean...
Dude, listen, a gun to Elon's head, if you told him, here's a bicycle, here's a lawnmower, make it motorized. Gun to his head, I don't think he could do it. Meanwhile, you give a crackhead 20 minutes and $5, he could probably make that bicycle fly.
Yeah. My favorite story is that they gave him a copy of the code to work on when he was at PayPal, because every time he would make changes, they would not like be any good. He was terrible. And so they gave him a copy of the code to use. And then he found out about it, apparently. So I think I can't remember what they said. They think they actually ended up making a completely separate code base that was just his, and they would update that one, but they would never push those changes to the vinyl version. So they still got him.
Fucking hilarious.
And that's where he worked with Peter Thiel.
Yeah, and then
they basically
kicked him out of the company.
Yeah, because he's an incompetent shitlord, basically.
Good lord. Okay.
Oh yeah, the whole conversation goes way down, about 5 inches deep. It's fucking they're the most shallow people you've ever met,
bro. We could do like a whole 10-parter on Elon. Trust me, it's bad.
He's not historical yet.
Yeah.
All we need is one
What's
more
our cutoff? He can't be hasty.
What is our cutoff? I mean, we could talk about we could talk about the rollout of Zip 2, his first Zip program, when every douchebag with a fucking programming environment was making a Zip program to try to sell on the internet.
I think 25 years is the correct amount of time before something's historical.
Bro, that puts us right in line with Zip 2. We can talk about jazz discs while we're at it and Aomega.
Howard was he was not a great student, although he liked mathematics, flying, and mechanics. He took his first flying lesson at 14.
Bitch, what?
And attended, 14.
Who the fuck has flying lessons? That's when you're like up north. That's when you find out like what school you're in economically, because they'll be like they have a hockey team. And any fucking school in New Jersey that has a hockey team, it's like, ooh, okay, you know. That's how you know.
So listen, funny story. Even UF has a hockey team. They just play in Jacksonville.
I'm talking about high school.
Oh.
Colleges, yeah.
Yeah. I think all the Florida schools have hockey teams.
But when you're in high school, you have a hockey team, it's like, come on.
But he attended the Fessenden School in Massachusetts in 1921. And yeah, after a brief stint at the Thacker School, he attended math and aeronautical engineering courses at Caltech.
The fact that he went to Fessenden, yeah, that tracks. This kid would have absolutely got swirled into the next fucking time zone.
You don't know that. He could have been like a jiu-jitsu nerd, you know?
No. He's taking flying lessons at 14. No, he's not a jiu-jitsu nerd.
The house where he lived as a teenager at 3921 Yoakum Boulevard in Houston still stands, now known as the Hughes House, on the grounds of the University of St. Thomas. His mother died in March of 1922 from complications of a ectopic pregnancy.
Man.
Howard, his father died of a heart attack in 1924. Their deaths inspired him to include the establishment of a medical research laboratory in the will that he signed in 1925 at age 19. Howard Sr.'s will had not been updated since his wife's death, and Hughes Jr. inherited 75% of the family fortune. On his 19th birthday, Howard was declared an emancipated minor, enabling him to take full control of his life.
Enabling him to upgrade his mining equipment.
Bro, this is like the early 1900s. He was a fucking, like, a fully grown man at age, like, 12. Also, at 18, you're no longer a miner.
I believe at 21, the age of... 21, because remember the age of... the voting age was 21.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was 21. So I believe until you hit 21, you were not considered an adult.
That's fair.
Should be 27.
Have you talked to a 20-year-old? They're fucking morons.
Dude, I read... I actually follow... Ever since COVID, I follow r/teachers on Reddit. I just got interested in it because of what was going on with school, and my mom was having to do it. You know, she teaches. And
the kids are just getting dumber by the fucking year.
Every other post is about it. Like, there are high school teachers on there. It can't be a meme. There's got to be something going on, because there are teachers on there who are posting, like, these kids are in 11th grade, and they can't spell basic words, and they don't know how to write.
Nope. They come into the hospital, and I have to, like, I'll talk to kids as young as 16, like, mom and dad will be there, or whoever's there, and mom will try to answer for them. I'm like, no, stop. They're here. Like, I understand your mom, but this is a 16-year-old. Like, I need them to speak, and they just, like, know nothing. They know nothing about their own health. They're just completely lost and clueless, and I'm just like, this is terrifying.
Yeah.
Holy shit, these kids are dumb.
From a young age, Howard was a proficient and enthusiastic golfer. He often scored near par, playing the game to a 2-3 handicap during his 20s, and for a time aiming to become a professional golfer. He golfed frequently with top players, including Gene Sarazen. He rarely played competitively and gradually gave up his passion for the sport to pursue other interests. He would play golf, though, every afternoon at the Los Angeles courses, including the Lakeside Golf Club, the Wilshire Golf Country Club, or the Bel Air Country Club. And his partners were often George Von Elm or Ozzie Carlton. But after he hurt himself in the late 1920s, his golfing tapered off after he crashed his XF-11 aircraft, and he was unable to play at all after that.
XF-11? That sounds like he's flying a goddamn fighter jet. What was that?
Well, it pretty much is, because he was like one of the first civilians to break sort of like airspeed records in a private aircraft. But the problem was that he kept crashing the aircrafts, which kept continually injuring him. And by the end of his life, he would have definitely been addicted to, spoilers, he did end up being addicted to opioids, but he would have been addicted to, you know, to modern opioids instead of the ones that he ended up using.
Yeah, like the actual real morphine.
Right. Actually, it's not opioids. He got addicted to cocaine, but.
That's okay. So you really got to be specific there, because that's the exact opposite of an opioid.
It's the
polar opposite. It's like the fire to opioids ice. I mean, Jesus.
Wow.
You can have cocaine or a Berk 30. Which one do you want?
Mix them. They're called speed balls when you do those three things together.
There was that show, The Nick, and it was about a Gilded Age, like, doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, like, it was very realistic in, like, the surgeries and stuff they showed. Mm. But the doctor was, like, a real, like, scumbag who was addicted to, like, drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, he ends up killing himself by essentially inventing the speedball.
That's awesome.
Because he's like, I really love downers, and I really love uppers. What if I could combine them perfectly?
The entire world, including Chris Farley and John Belushi, thank you, dickhead.
Yeah, good work.
Thanks, bro.
But Hughes would withdraw from Rice University shortly after his father's death. On June 1st, 1925, he married Ella Botts Rice, the daughter of David Rice and Martha Lawson Botts of Houston, and great-niece of William Marsh Rice, for whom Rice University was named. They moved to Los Angeles, where he hoped to make a name for himself as a filmmaker. They moved into the Ambassador Hotel, and Hughes proceeded to learn to fly a Waco while simultaneously producing his first motion picture, Swell Hogan. In 1929, Hogan? After 4 years of marriage, Ella returned to Houston and filed for divorce.
Swell Hogan. What you gonna do, brother?
Alternatively called Santa with Muscle.
Okay, little dude. Pasta Mania.
You're going to listen to me.
We'll take you over to Pasta Mania. Brother. Dude.
No side bread for him, dude.
When the never-ending pasta bowl runs wild on you, bro.
Have you heard of that, by the way? Pasta Mania?
No.
Oh, dude, he literally had a restaurant called Pasta Mania.
Oh,
like,
my God.
Like, no bullshit. Yeah. And it has, there's an episode of this podcast Steve Deadlock glued me into. Yeah, Deadlock. And they're like an indie wrestling thing. And they're very funny. And they did this episode about it. I mean, it is, it's hilarious. I just can't believe it was a fucking thing. Like, they just started reading the menu at one point, and I was trying to go to bed, and I'm like, I gotta change this fucking podcast, because I can't stop listening to this shit. It's fucking hilarious.
Well, you know what's funny, too, is I think Eminem opened up a shop.
And yeah, Mom's Spaghetti. Mom's Spaghetti.
And but he's that, like, just runs it out of, like, a window.
But that's like,
it's fucking that, awesome.
That's way more interesting than Hulk Hogan showing up and shoving pasta in your face and screaming. And then, no, dude, no work boots in here, brother. No sports jerseys, brother.
Get that do-rag out of here, brother.
I'm trying to keep a certain element out of my pasta mania, dude.
There's I saw that there's a place like there's a like a thrift store in Minneapolis that has the Pasta Mania awning on the outside of it.
Oh no!
Because the Pasta Mania was in Mall of America.
Uh huh.
It opened for the inaugural like episode of WCW Nitro.
Okay.
Mm.
And they showed it because that's where all the clips are from that episode.
Oh, that's fucking hilarious.
Hughes, as mentioned previously, had a very successful business career beyond engineering, aviation, and filmmaking. Many of his career endeavors involved varying entrepreneurial roles. So he was very good at like investing his money and investing in things. He would often like buy up things and just to, like buy them up and then just sell them later.
Okay.
He would date many famous women throughout his life, including Joan Crawford, Terry Moore, Deborah Padgett, Billy Dove, Faith.
You had me at Joan Crawford, bro.
Domergue, Betty Davis, Yvonne DiCarlo, Ava Gardner, Olivia de Havilland,
Olivia de Havilland,
Hedy Lamarr.
What are you reading off Ginger Sean Rogers. Connery's knock his his kill list here? Yeah. And Charles twice.
Well, if they did, they're now what it was.
Olivia de Havilland and Charles twice.
him and Jack Warner. There's a lot of repeats.
I'm all done here.
Gloria Vanderbilt, Mammy Van Doren, and Jean Tierney.
Last one's surprising.
He also proposed to Joan Fontaine several times, according to her autobiography, No Bed of Roses. Jean Harlow accompanied him to the premiere of Hell's Angels, which was one of the movies he made. But Noah Dietrich wrote many years later that the relationship was strictly professional, as Hughes disliked Harlow personally. In his 1971 book, Howard, the Amazing Mr. Hughes, Dietrich said that Hughes genuinely liked and respected Jane Russell, but never sought romantic involvement with her. According to her biography, however, Hughes once tried to bed her after a party. Russell at the time, who was married, refused to sleep with him, and Hughes promised it would never happen again. The two maintained a professional and private friendship for many years. Hughes remained good friends with Tierney, who, after his failed attempts to seduce her, was quoted as saying, "I don't think Howard could love anything that did not have a motor in it." later, when Tierney's daughter, Daria, was born deaf and blind with a severe learning disability because of her exposure to rubella during her pregnancy, Hughes saw to it that she received the best medical care and paid all expenses. In 1933, Hughes made a purchase of a luxury steam yacht named the Rover, which was previously owned by Scottish shipping magnate James Mackay, 1st Earl of Inchcap. Hughes stated, "I have never seen the Rover, but bought it on the blueprints, photographs, and the reports of Lloyd's surveyors. My experience is that the English are the most honest race in the world."
What? 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 Shit. Okay. All right. All right.
Yeah, not if you're brown or gay.
Hughes renamed the yacht Southern Cross and later sold her to Swedish entrepreneur Axel Wennergren. On July 11th, 1936, Hughes struck and killed a pedestrian named Gabriel S. Meyer with his car at the corner of 3rd Street and Lorraine in Los Angeles.
Is he the Matthew Broderick?
After the crash, Hughes was taken to the hospital and certified as sober, but an attending doctor made a note that Hughes had been drinking. A witness to the crash told police that Hughes was driving erratically and too fast and that Mayer had been standing in the safety zone of a streetcar stop. Hughes was booked on suspicion of negligent homicide and held overnight in jail until his attorney, Neil S. McCarthy, obtained a writ of habeas corpus for his release pending a coroner's inquest.
Jesus Christ, but okay.
By the time of the coroner's inquiry, however, the witness had changed the story and claimed that Mayer had moved directly in front of Hughes' car. Nancy Bailey Watts, who was in the car with Hughes at the time of the crash, corroborated this version of the story. On July 16, 1936, Hughes was held blameless by a coroner's jury at the inquest into Mayer's death. Hughes told reporters outside the inquiry, "I was driving slowly and a man stepped out of the darkness in front of me."
I mean, that's like the excuse that everybody gives. Still bullshit.
He was coming back from a pornography store. He was right. Buying pornography.
I was at the pornography store. I was coming back from buying pornography at the pornography store.
On January 12, 1957, Hughes married actress Jean Peters at a small hotel in Tonopah, Nevada. The couple met in the 1940s before Peters became a film actress.
I mean, was he like a philanderer or did he, or was he like, was there a problem? I mean, obviously we know there was a problem later, but like, why the fuck did he have so many women? It just doesn't make sense.
I think he was kind of like David Lynch, where he sounds like he was just like a person who was like so difficult to be around that these women like leave him eventually.
Okay.
But that's like what all the women say about David Lynch is that just like,
I'm at the store eating a donut. I'm not going to be home for a week. Jane here says the coffee's delicious. It's just fucking David Lynch sending you a fucking letter in the mail.
I bought these four Woody Woodpecker dolls at the gas station on La Brea. They are my sons. I love them dearly.
I love Steve's David Lynch impression. It's so good. That's what he does. He talks just like he does in Twin Peaks when he's like got the headphones on or whatever. I forget.
Yeah, exactly. When he's the FBI director.
Yeah.
I forget his name. But
he's got like the headphones on and he's like yelling, "Now, Coop!" You know, and just that's how he talks in real life.
I told them to change their hearts or die.
He kind of says things like Action Bronson would rap, you know?
Yeah. Oh, God.
The Decembers in Washington are not unlike macaroni stew. What? Winters after I sold a peanut's breath. Wait, what are you fucking talking about?
Literally sounds like you're talking in code.
You know, actually, go listen to Action Bronson and tell me I'm even like. There's a whole meme about it. Like he just says shit.
Hughes and Peters had a highly publicized romance in 1947. There was talk of marriage, but she could not combine it with her career. Some later claimed that Peters was "quote unquote" the only woman Hughes ever loved, and he reportedly had his security officers follow her everywhere, even when they were not in a relationship. Such reports were confirmed by actor Max Showalter, who became a close friend of Peters while shooting Niagara in 1953. Showalter told an interviewer that because he frequently met with Peters, Hughes' men threatened to ruin his career if he did not leave her alone.
Oof, okay.
Niagara, that was wasn't that like a popular movie?
I think so. Shortly before the 1960 presidential election, Richard Nixon was alarmed when it was revealed that his brother, Donald, had received a $205,000 loan from Hughes.
Dick and Donald Nixon.
It has long been speculated that Nixon's drive to learn what the Democrats were planning in 1972 was based in part on his belief that the Democrats knew about a later bribe that his friend Bebe Rebozo had received from Hughes after Nixon took office.
And you wouldn't believe, if you think Bebe was bad, you wouldn't believe Bebe's kids.
Oh, those kids are awful.
Oh, they're terrible.
These goddamn hippie kids.
Oh, I gotta figure out what's going on with my jowls.
Jolly fuck.
Where's my brother?
Now, Sparrow, you're gonna have to kill these kids.
Who, Bebe's kids? Nobody's gonna get that fucking reference,
brother.
You're my
number one guy.
You realize that? Oh my god. No, you don't, he doesn't get that line, bro. Come on. That's one of the best lines ever. He needs to go up to my buddy ever. I hadn't seen him for a while. Grab him by the shoulders. Mike, you're my number one guy.
But Bebe's kids was one of those, like, if you're from our, like, sort of generational group.
Robin Harris.
You'll know exactly what it is because they also used to play constantly on HBO.
Oh yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know it was on HBO.
Yeah, they used to play it like all the time, especially during like the summer when they would do like the free like HBO weeks.
Yeah.
In late 1971, Donald Nixon was collecting intelligence for his brother in preparation for the upcoming presidential election, and one of his sources was John H. Mayer, a former business advisor of Hughes, who had also worked with Democratic National Committee Chairman Larry O'Brien.
Larry O'Brien, that's leaping, Larry.
Yep. Great uncle to Conan.
Mayer, in collaboration with former Vice President Hubert Humphrey and others, wanted to feed misinformation to the Nixon campaign. Mayer told Donald that he was sure the Democrats would win the election because Larry O'Brien had a great deal of information on Richard Nixon's illicit dealings with Howard Hughes that had never been released.
Do you guys see that FEMA coordinator didn't know that there was a hurricane season?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Fucking dumbass.
Like, don't they, isn't that just like a month? I don't know why we're talking about this.
I was just blown away.
O'Brien did not actually have any such information, but Mayer wanted Nixon to think
O'Brien.
That he did. Donald told his brother that O'Brien was in possession of damaging information that could destroy his campaign.
Yo, he's got some hot-ass tea, bro.
Scorching.
You're about to get cooked, son.
Terry Lenzner, who was the chief investigator for the Senate Watergate Committee, speculates that it was Nixon's desire to know what O'Brien knew about Nixon's dealings with Hughes that may have partially motivated the Watergate break-in.
Oh, my God. By the way, I started 100 Years of Solitude again. It's like a fever dream, man. Like, the beginning...
Why?
There's just so much shit going on, and just... I don't know what it is about that book. It just... It's off-putting.
The magical realism, it hit different.
It's definitely weird.
Hughes was widely considered eccentric and suffered from severe obsessive-compulsive disorder.
He was eccentric because, and not crazy because he was rich.
Mm-hmm.
Poor people are crazy. Rich people are eccentric.
This guy said he wants to buy all the waffles. All of them. He's insane. Wait, no, it's Howie Hughes' son. Oh.
In the trunk of his car, he had a... He had like sort of like the air filter from an airplane, like you know how they circulate the air in the cabin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he had one of those in his car.
Why?
In the trunk because he was such a germaphobe.
Oh my god.
Dietrich wrote that Hughes ate the same dinner daily: a New York strip steak cooked medium rare, dinner salad and peas, but only the smaller peas, pushing the larger ones aside.
What
for breakfast? What? Yeah.
How the fuck do you do? Okay. Peas are not universal in size. They're all different shapes and sizes. So what delineates a large pea from a small pea?
Well, the man knows what he likes, and he likes the small peas.
I'll tell you what it is,
large
dude.
Peas, Ryan.
I don't know why. Every episode we got to have a conversation about penis, you know?
These peas are chock full of green penis.
Country goodness and green penis.
As I told one of the urologists I met one time, I was like, you could have done great things. The heart, the brain, the lungs. Nope, you went right for the penis. He thought it was funny. So I was like, whew, thank God.
A friend of mine, one of his med school buddies, he was he became a urologist, and mm-hmm. I joked with him, you know, we have to make sure our boys can perform out there in the field. He thought that was hilarious. For breakfast, his eggs had to be cooked the way that his family cook Lily had made them.
Which is how?
And just the exact way she cooked them. They didn't go into detail about it. I don't know they were like over easy or whatever.
He strikes me as an over medium kind of guy.
Yeah. He had a phobia about germs and a passion for secrecy that bordered on mania. I think it also became mania as well. While directing the film The Outlaw, he became fixated on a small flaw in one of Jane Russell's blouses, claiming that the fabric bunched up along a seam and gave the appearance of two nipples on each breast.
Oh my God.
He wrote a detailed memorandum to the crew on how to fix the problem. Richard Fleischer, who directed His Kind of Woman with Hughes as executive producer, wrote at length in his autobiography about the difficulty of dealing with the tycoon. In his book, Just Tell Me When to Cry, Fleischer explained that Hughes was fixated on trivial details and was alternatively indecisive and obstinate. He also revealed that Hughes' unpredictable mood swings made him wonder if the film would ever be completed. In 1957, Hughes told his aides that he wanted to screen some movies at a film studio near his home. Because remember, he is like the principal owner of RKO Studios, so it's not just like he's just like, he is very rich, but it's also like, he's also the head of like a film company during this time
period. Yeah, so he's a pervo who's going to lock himself in a room with the talent, you know.
Well, he locks himself in the room, and he stays in the studio's darkened screening room for more than 4 months, never leaving. He ate only chocolate bars and chicken and drank only milk and was surrounded by dozens of boxes of Kleenex that he continually stacked and rearranged.
I mean, dude, that sounds like my like mid-20s. I mean, I don't really understand. I mean, you do it every once in a while, you know? Especially the tissues part, by the way. And stacking and rearranging them is like rule number one. If you're not doing that, I mean, you're not getting the full tissue experience, you know?
He wrote detailed memos to his aides, giving them explicit instructions neither to look at him nor speak to him unless spoken to.
Oh, so he's Steve Harvey.
or Prince. Prince also had the rule backstage. Throughout this period, Hughes would sit fixated in his chair, often naked, continuously watching movies.
What?
When he finally emerged in the spring of 1958... his hygiene was in terrible condition. He had neither bathed nor cut his hair and nails for weeks. This may have been due to allodynia, which results in a pain response to stimuli that would normally not cause pain.
Oh, yeah.
So the idea is that he just sort of locked himself in there and fixated on these movies because anything else would have caused him to have this like pain response.
Okay. You said alopecia?
No,
it almost sounded like you named like some kind of you know, Muslim like early world like scientist, you know, Aludinium.
It sounds like,
you know, Aludinia, you know, he discovered trigonometry.
M. Ibn Sina, they discovered that the earth was somewhat round well before the white man.
After this incident, Hughes moved into a bungalow at the Beverly Hills Hotel, where he also rented rooms for his aides, his wife, and numerous girlfriends. He would sit naked in his bedroom with a pink hotel napkin placed over his genitals watching movies. This may have been because he found the touch of clothing painful due to the aforementioned allodynia.
You think maybe this is just like the world's longest goon, maybe?
Probably. He's not gooning, you know, he's just...
Yeah. No, he's, I don't know, man. Gooning. I don't think you know that, you know? He's wealthy. He could have convinced the whole world that he wasn't gooning.
Well, they didn't say he was watching stag movies unless, you know, he just, like...
Some people don't goon to that, though. Some people need the story.
Just think about Jane, you know? Russell's blouse.
Some people don't do that, you know? The stag, you know, you gotta have the lead up, you know?
He may have also watched the movies to distract himself from his pain that I mentioned from his numerous airplane crashes, a common practice among patients with extreme pain, especially those who do not receive adequate treatment. In 1 year, it was estimated that he spent $11 million at the hotel.
Good God.
That's almost $12
million. Hughes began purchasing restaurant chains and 4-star hotels that had been founded within the state of Texas. This included, for only a short period, many unknown franchises currently out of business. He placed ownership of the restaurants with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and all licenses were resold shortly after. In 1968, he became obsessed with the film Ice Station Zebra.
Ooh, that's a good one.
And he had it run on a continuous loop in his home. According to his aides, he watched the film 150 times.
Okay, it's not that good. It's good.
Look,
it's not,
man, I'm not judging him, okay? Everyone's got their comfort show, you know? Like, if I watch The Office, if I even turn it on, I'll watch The whole Office again, and it'll be like 25 times.
Seinfeld. For me, it's Futurama, but I get it.
Seinfeld, It's Always Sunny. Diva. I don't know, man. I'm not going to judge.
Feeling guilty about the failure of his film, The Conqueror, which is the movie where John Wayne plays
the fucking cancer movie,
where it was shot on an atomic bomb testing site. And while some people say that everybody got cancer from filming there, you know, they were all smoking like 3 packs a day. So who could say who won
because,
that race?
Because that's the thing with cancer is that it's additive. It's cumulative.
Yeah, just ask Rush Limbaugh.
So if you were already in a place where the cells might make a mistake because you know you've been burning Winston's for fucking 45 years, and drinking, and eating like shit, right? Then you spend even a little bit of time near an atomic bomb range.
You're
and
done.
Multiple people get cancer there. Like, come on. I mean, it's correlated.
You are
there's correlation. It's not causation, but it's certainly correlation.
Because the
also,
movie
it's
was
fucking
a
racist as shit, by the way.
Because
John
because
Wayne
the movie,
being Genghis Khan
in yellowface.
Ugh.
Because the movie was a commercial and critical flop, he bought every copy of the film for $12 million, watching the film on repeat.
Oh my god.
This guy's just got bad taste, you know? You ever meet someone like that? They watch what you watch, but then they also watch something else, and you're like, fuck me, dude.
Watching the movie on repeat in your basement does not increase the overall views of the movie, bro. It's not going to make it better.
He just thought he was in today, and he was just trying to gamify YouTube.
Yeah.
Paramount Pictures acquired the rights to the film in 1979, 3 years after Hughes' death. Hughes insisted on using tissues to pick up objects in order to protect himself from germs. He would also notice dust, stains, or other imperfections on people's clothes and demand that they take care of them. Once being one of the most visible men in American public life, Hughes ultimately vanished from public view, although tabloids continue to follow rumors of his behavior and whereabouts. He was reported to be terminally ill, mentally unstable, or even to be dead. As I mentioned, the injuries from numerous aircraft crashes caused him to spend much of his later life in pain, and he eventually became addicted to codeine, which he injected intravenously, or intramuscularly.
Yeah.
I was about to say, if he's injecting codeine himself intravenously, boy, he is light years ahead of the 70s. Oh, yeah. Boy.
He's just popping it.
He's doing
leg.
It intramuscularly.
That shit sucks when they do it intramuscularly because it's it hurts, man. Like, that's the COVID
it
shot.
It should not hurt if they do it correctly. It should
not
hurt.
If they know where to COVID hit. Shot, they got me. She got me bad. She definitely got me in the wrong part of the shoulder meat, and it was like inflamed. I mean, everyone's first COVID shot, you know, you got a little bit of pain in the area, but like, it was like super bad, and then it was black and blue. So I was like, oh, okay.
She probably hit you too high and damn near hit your fucking
joint.
Well,
you know, it's crazy because it's 2025, right? That really wasn't that long ago. And I don't know if you remember this, but I don't know how you got it, actually. But we drove through the Orange County Convention Center parking garage to get our shots. Mm-hmm.
I got mine at work at the hospital.
Yeah, like we were still quarantining. And so we had to go through like the convention center. It might be one of the best feelings in the world, by the way. Like
we had to get the shot and then sit there for 20 minutes to make sure nothing happened to you.
Yeah, that you didn't have anaphylaxis. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it was go back to work.
I felt a little something on the first shot because my anxiety got so high because I was just so like worried about everything at the time, you know, but then it was nothing. I get that with every vaccine I get too. Like the same thing with flu.
Well, I started to feel like shit. The next day, and
yeah,
I was
you,
like, oh,
yeah,
this must be just the fucking after effects to get the shot. Oh, nope, I got fucking COVID.
Yeah, I remember that.
I had COVID while I had
the shot. Yeah, you weren't supposed to do that. And I remember that. We talked about it on the Discord. Yeah.
Yeah, because I didn't know that I had COVID until like the next morning. And I was like, oh, fuck me. I just like, I'm in the shower with my body wash and I'm like, I can't smell this. And I like run naked.
You're in the shower with your body wash. You call your roommate.
And I'm like, I can't.
You're just like, hey, bro.
Fucking Olive Garden.
Can you do me a favor? Can you open the door and turn on the movie The Conqueror by John Wayne? I'm going to watch it for the next 14 years.
Yeah, just click the repeat button and just walk away.
Just ignore the smell, by the way.
Can you imagine if this guy would have been alive long enough to get COVID? Oh, my God. He would have been one of the people driving in the car with a mask on.
He would have sealed himself away like they claim like Putin did. Or like how Howard Stern does.
Yeah, Howard Stern's been like that for years. Because
apparently Howard Stern only broke, only left his like Florida compound because his wife was going to divorce him because it was like 2023 or whatever, and he was still like quarantining.
Oh shit.
But I was correct earlier. I misspoke because he did not become addicted to cocaine. He became addicted to codeine, which is an opiate.
Yes, codeine is an opiate.
Yeah, codeine's codeine's not great, by the way. I don't know how you
codeine's get... great shit, bro.
I've taken cough, codeine. I've taken codeine.
Codeine? Oh,
no, I've taken shit. Codeine, but I'm saying it just I'd rather have, you know, I don't know. Probably oxy.
It makes me sick. I get sick on opiates.
Yeah, a lot of people have that problem. Yeah. You know?
I found that out after I got my wisdom teeth pulled and I'm like, oh, this feels better, and then I just started throwing up for the next like
he brought the pills to the minutes. Pharmacist the next day. The pharmacist took the pills and immediately put the stamp on it. Just says big baby, you know, big baby can
bro, my,
pill.
My dentist hooked me up after my wisdom teeth. He hooked me up with Toradol like pills.
Oh, that's the God. Shit right there.
No, he was like, I can also give you Percocet. I'm like, nah, keep that fucking nonsense.
How about Molly?
The Toradol
Percocet?
Is where it is at. Thank you.
Yeah, this is terrible. I mean, all of this in Minecraft, you know.
Hughes had his hair cut and nails trimmed only once per year, likely due to the pain caused by his numerous conditions, mental and physical. He also stored his urine in bottles.
What? What?
Wait, is that weird or?
if you've seen the casino episode of The Simpsons, how Mr. Burns gets, that's supposed to be Howard Hughes.
Yeah, that's when he's Howard Hughes. Yeah.
Yeah. As he was aging, he would be accompanied by his entourage of personal aides who began moving from one hotel to another, always taking up residence in the top four penthouses. In the last 10 years of his life, from 1966 to 1976, he lived in hotels in many cities, including Beverly Hills, Boston, Las Vegas, Nassau, Freeport, and Vancouver.
Beverly Hills.
Should have stayed in Vancouver.
On November 24th, 1966, Thanksgiving Day, he arrived in Las Vegas by railroad car and moved into the Desert Inn. Because he refused to leave the hotel and to avoid further conflicts with the owners, Hughes bought the Desert Inn in early 1967.
God, that's okay. So this dude has fuck you money, is what he's got.
Yes.
Oh, no.
Buy your hotel.
No,
fuck
he
you.
Definitely has fuck you money, bro. If that's even a real thing, he has it. It's,
Yeah, yes, yes.
Well,
yes.
Yeah, I'll tell you what fuck you. I'll tell you what fuck you money is. I saw something today. I don't know if it was real or not, so maybe I'll call myself out if I was wrong, but Jeff Bezos was having like furniture delivered to a building. I think it was in New York. And literally, you know those big fucking construction cranes?
Yeah.
They were using that to get the furniture up to the floors of the building that he owned. That's
Listen,
fuck you money.
As much as I hate to admit it, Elon Musk has fuck you money because the dude bought fucking Twitter because people were making fun of him. That is fuck
you
money.
He has monopoly money, but think about this. Yeah. Peter Thiel is also very rich, but his money's real. A lot of Elon's money is wrapped up
by Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why he's so much more dangerous, again.
Elon Musk is sitting there like, the price of emeralds is going down, so my net worth is also growing down.
The hotel's 8th floor became the center of Hughes' empire, and the 9th floor penthouse became his residence. Between 1966 and 1968, He brought several other hotel casinos, including the Castaways, 66, New Frontier, 68.
Hey.
The Landmark, the Landmark Hotel and Casino in the Sands. He was rumored to have bought the Silver Slipper Casino to move its trademark neon silver slipper, which was visible from his bedroom. But this is not. But this is not credible.
Oh, I was gonna say, bro. That okay? Yeah, yeah. This he's got too much money at this point.
I mean, you're Steve, are you like me though? Like when you hear the word casino, do you immediately think of the movie Casino? Every time.
Yeah,
kind of. After Hughes left the Desert Inn, hotel employees discovered that the drapes had not been opened during the time he lived there and had rotted through.
Holy shit.
Hughes wanted to change the image of Las Vegas.
That's
to something
probably the least
glamorous.
Crazy thing he did, though. I mean, men don't move the drapes. Why?
So what was he... Okay, so then if That's he was so mad work. About the neon sign from the hotel that he alleged to have bought just to move the sign, if he never opened the drapes to his bedroom, how the fuck was he going to see the sign in the first place?
Well, that, look, that's why I said look, it was dude. A rumor. It wasn't, I saw it was incredible. Sign. It was right. a rumor.
Oh, okay.
And it opened up my eyes.
Yeah. You might want to be careful about that, Steve. That sign was national with a swastika.
I'm well aware of the fact that they were Nazis. Ace of Base were Nazis. Or at least the one guy is, and the other guys didn't know, maybe? I don't know.
He wrote, it's just like...
Isn't his name like Ulf always... Stormberg or something? So it's like, yeah, you guys didn't see that. I did not see that coming. You know?
like wait a minute. Like it's always sunny when they go to the summer camp. It's like, yeah, that guy was really, really jazzed up about stuff. We had a lot of fun. And they play the video, yeah, and it's like a Aryan Nation camp.
So bad, dude.
Hughes, like I said, wanted to change the image of Las Vegas into something more glamorous. He wrote in a memo to an aide.
He doesn't open his goddamn window. Never mind. Go ahead.
I like to think of Las Vegas in terms of a well-dressed man in a dinner jacket and a beautifully jeweled and furred female getting out of an expensive car.
Oh, you don't know what that looks like, bro. You don't leave the hotel room.
but he has the theater of the mind, Ryan. He also has a TV that's playing
so
Ice Station Zebra on constant loop.
So then you don't have to buy shit. You can just watch it on TV, you fucking turd. What the fuck?
By the way, he bought several local Las Vegas TV stations, including KLS TV, which is like the main rate like TV station in Las Vegas. And he also would have like call into them and make them play like Ice Station Zero a bunch of times or Ice Station Zebra.
It's fucking hilarious.
Eventually, the brain trauma from his previous accidents, the effects of neurosyphilis diagnosed in 1932, and a undiagnosed obsessive-compulsive disorder considerably affected his decision-making.
Neurosyphilis makes it sound so much worse than just saying the word syphilis. You know, they said I got neurosyphilis. Yeah.
Well, it is worse. It's when the syphilis is untreated for so long that now it affects your spinal cord.
No, I get that. I'm just saying, it sounds a lot worse, you know.
You know,
even banging, you've had so much syphilis. You dipped your winky in so much syphilitic fish water that you got neurosyphilis. Okay, you're full.
Said fish.
You
water.
Can't get any more syphilis into that fucking corpulent ass body of yours.
Oh God, yeah, neurosyphilis sounds much worse because
baby
it looks way
you?
Worse.
Yeah. All right, so he's dead.
Well, now, a small panel unofficially dubbed the Mormon Mafia for the many Latter-day Saints on the committee was led by Frank William Gay and originally served as Hughes' secret police headquartered at 7000 Romaine, Hollywood. Over the next two decades, this group, though, they oversaw and controlled the considerable business holdings of Hughes, with the CIA anointing Greg while awarding a contract to the Hughes Corporation to acquire sensitive information on a sunken Russian submarine.
Oh, is this that thing where the CIA went and, like, got the Russian sub off the bottom of the fucking...
Yeah, like, the Glomer...
Yeah. The boat?
The Glomer Explorer, where they essentially just use Howard Hughes' money to, like, build this boat and use him as a cover... To like steal a Soviet submarine underneath the Soviet.
Oh, was that
nose.
His? That was his money.
Yeah.
Oh.
Speaking okay. of Soviet stuff, that freaking Ukrainian attack is unbelievable, man.
Oh, what, where they hit all the nuclear bombers?
They took out a third of their Russia's nuclear capacity. I think 70% of their bombing air. I think the bombers are just destroyed. It took a year to put into place. They launched fucking attack drones from like delivery and shipping crates and shit, and trucks, rented cars.
That's fucking hysterical.
It was so well coordinated that they almost destroyed the entire capability. Like, it's the people, they're calling it Russia's Pearl Harbor. Like, it's like one of the worst things ever.
And well, that's not good, because remember what happened after Pearl Harbor.
I understand that very well, bro.
Japanese back to the fucking Stone Age, bro.
I understand that very well.
I don't think the current crop of Russians fighting men are the greatest generation.
No. Yeah. Unfortunately, a lot of them are basically forced out there now.
They've been floundering against a nation that's like a fifth their size, if even that, like army wise.
Doug, Ukraine, their soldiers are like making bombs and like making artillery and their weapons out of shit that you get from like fucking True Value and Ace Hardware, and they're just decimating fucking Russia at every turn.
Some Polish
and
guys like
funniest
that.
Fucking thing ever. They like sunk Russia's
flagship.
Give them
a coffee can and a hope they could get something going for you. You know. Resilient.
They had like deep sea fishing rods and a stick of dynamite, and they destroyed Russia's flagship in the Black Sea. It's the funniest shit in the fucking world.
the Mormon Mafia, other than supervising the day to day business operation of Hughes's financial yes. empire, Hughes's they also took care of Hughes's health. They would also go to great pains to satisfy his every whim. An example of this is. Hughes once became fond of Baskin-Robbins banana nut ice cream, so his aides sought to secure a bulk shipment for him, only to discover that Baskin-Robbins had discontinued the flavor. They put in a request for the smallest amount the company could provide for a special order, which was 350 gallons.
Oh, shit.
They had it shipped from Los Angeles. A few days after the order arrived, Hughes announced he was tired of banana nut and wanted only crunch vanilla ice cream.
What a piece of shit.
Man, that's just, you know what that is? That's just king shit right there, bro.
If you're one of his aides, dude, no, bro. Now I'm going to hold you down and force feed you every fucking gallon, bro. Fuck you.
Yeah, I'm going to Wu-Tang you. I'm going to feed you and feed you. Oh my God, dude.
All right, Desert Inn ended up...
Is he fucking dead yet?
No. he's still got like 6-7 more years.
Wow.
The Desert Inn ended up distributing free banana nut ice cream to casino customers for a year.
That's awesome.
In a 1996 interview, former Howard Hughes chief of Nevada operations, Robert Mayhew, said, "There's a rumor that there is still some banana nut ice cream left in the freezer. It is most likely true."
That's fucking hilarious.
As an owner of several major Las Vegas businesses, Hughes wielded much political and economic influence in Nevada and elsewhere. During the 1960s and early 70s, he disapproved of underground nuclear testing at the Nevada test site. He was concerned about the risk of residual nuclear radiation and attempted to halt the tests. When the tests finally went through, despite his efforts, the detonations were powerful enough that the entire hotel in which he was living trembled from the shockwaves. In two separate last-ditch maneuvers, Hughes instructed his representatives to offer bribes of $1 million to both Presidents Lyndon B. Johnson and Richard Nixon.
Oh, I'll take it.
In 1970, Gene Peters filed for divorce.
Wait, they were still fucking married that whole time?
Yes. They had not lived together for many years, but Peters requested a lifetime alimony payment of $70,000 a year, adjusted for inflation, and waived all claims to Hughes' estate. Hughes offered her a settlement of over $1 million, but she declined it. Hughes did not insist on a confidentiality agreement from Peters as a condition of the divorce. Aides reported that Hughes never spoke ill of her. She refused to discuss her life with Hughes and declined several lucrative offers from publishers and biographers.
$70,000 a year in 1970. That's like a $500 million. It's like $500 million a year now. It's funny.
That's just a Powerball every month. Peters would state only that she had not seen Hughes for several years before their divorce and had dealt with him only by phone. Hughes was living in the Intercontinental Hotel near Lake Managua in Nicaragua, seeking privacy and security when a magnitude 6.5 earthquake damaged Managua in December of 1972.
Lake Managua sounds like a lake where you see like a fucking cryptid, you know?
Yeah.
Just hear like Whitley Strieber talking about. Today we're talking about Lake Managua's Chupacabras.
Oh my fucking God. $70,000 in 1970 is worth approximately $560,000 to $580,000 today.
Yeah, that tracks.
Jesus fucking Christ.
As a precaution, Hughes moved to a large tent facing the hotel. After a few days, he moved to the Nicaraguan National Palace and stayed there as a guest of Anastasio Somoza Dibaila, before leaving for Florida on a private jet the following day. He subsequently moved into the penthouse at the Xanadu Princess Resort on Grand Bahama Island, which he had recently purchased. He lived almost exclusively in the penthouse of the Xanadu Beach Resort and Marina for the last 4 years of his life. He spent a total of $300 million on his many properties in Las Vegas. In 1972, author Clifford Irving caused a media sensation when he claimed he had co-written and authorized Hughes' autobiography. Irving claimed he and Hughes had corresponded through the United States mail and offered as proof handwritten notes allegedly sent by Hughes. Publisher McGraw-Hill was duped into believing the manuscript was authentic. Hughes, at this time, was so reclusive, they did not immediately publicly refute Irving's statement, leading many to believe that his book was genuine. However, before the book was published, Hughes finally denounced Irving in a teleconference attended by reporters Hughes knew personally, James Bacon of Hearst Newspapers, Marvin Miles of the Los Angeles Times, Vernon Scott of UPI, Roy Neal of NBC News, Gene Hansaker of AP, Wayne Thomas of the Chicago Tribune, and Gladwin Hill of the New York Times.
Damn, so he called a press conference just to be like, that guy's full of shit. All right, I'm going back to the hotel room.
The entire hoax began to unravel. The U.S. Postal Inspection Service got a subpoena to force Irving to turn over samples of his handwriting. Yeah, you don't fuck with the United States Postal Inspection Service.
Listen, there's a couple people in America you don't fuck with here in the States, okay? The USPIS, and you don't fuck with Fish and Wildlife. Fish and Wildlife is the only branch of law enforcement that does not need a warrant. They can come walking right into your fucking house, and there's nothing you can do about it. They will jump right on your boat, and they don't give a shit. Open your cooler. I don't need a warrant. Fuck you. It is insane the amount of power those guys have.
Well, they can't just walk in your house, but they can...
Oh, yes, the fuck
now, they can. Certainly like a hunting cabin,
they can walk right in.
Now, Steve, I think I saw a gopher tortoise come into your house, so I'm going to need to go in there and buy that bad boy. That's it's burrowing saying, through like, your wall right now.
Listen, okay, they're not going to walk into your house in the middle of, like, you know, suburban Orlando, but if you have a hunting cabin, oh, yeah, they'll just knock and walk right in. I don't think you're storing a manatee in your house.
Oh, no.
he's telling his wife.
He's running to the bathroom to close the shower curtain. He's like, ah, shit, they got us.
He's trying to get it out on the shower curtain, like Free Willy. He's like, we got to get him out the back door. We got to get him out the back door. Keep the hose on him.
Dude, listen, can you, oh my God, holy fuck. All right, so if you're in the state of Florida, right, you know that if you even fucking touch a manatee while you're snorkeling, while you're in a boat, while you are anything, you are going to get fucking slammed by FWC. They are going to fuck your life up. That's a felony, right? That is a felony to touch a manatee.
Yeah.
Can you imagine having to stand in front of a judge and explain why there was a manatee in your bathtub that you're just hosing down?
Yeah. Oh my God! No, I can't
bury you, bro.
Now your honor. Now Jub is I like to call him. Now he likes to get hosed down around 2 or 3 in the afternoon. That's his preferred hosing time. And that's what we really
hosing time.
They're just gonna beat you with a fucking oar in open court.
Open up your doors.
Oh God.
I hate that song so much, by the way. Closing time. Oh, shut the fuck up.
The Postal Inspector Service investigation led to Irving's indictment and subsequent conviction for using the Postal Service to commit fraud. He was incarcerated for 17 months. In 1974, the Orson Welles film F for Fake included a section on the Hughes autobiography hoax, leaving a question open as to whether it was Hughes who took part in the teleconference, since so few people had heard or seen him in recent years. In 1977, the hoax by Clifford Irving was published in the United Kingdom, telling his story of these events. In 2006, the film The Hoax, starring Richard Gere, is also based on these events. Hughes is reported to have died on April 5th, 1976, at 1:27 p.m., on board an aircraft, a Learjet 24B N855W, owned by Richard Graff and piloted by Roger Sutton and Jeff Abrams. He was en route to his penthouse at the Acapulco Princess Hotel, now the Princess Mundo Imperial in Mexico, to the Methodist Hospital in Houston. His reclusiveness and possibly his drug use made him practically unrecognizable. His hair, beard, fingernails, and toenails were long. His tall 6'4"-inch frame now weighed barely 90 pounds, and the FBI had to use fingerprints to conclusively identify the body.
God damn.
His alias, John T. Conover, was used when his body arrived at a morgue in Houston on the day of his death. An autopsy recorded kidney failure as the cause of death. In an 18-month study investigating his drug abuse for the estate, it was found that, quote-unquote, someone administered a deadly injection of the painkiller to his comatose man, obviously needlessly and almost certainly fatal. He suffered from malnutrition and was covered in bed sores. While his kidneys were damaged, his other internal organs, including his brain, which had no visible damage or illness, were deemed perfectly healthy. X-rays revealed five broken off hypodermic needles in the flesh of his arms.
Well, then.
To inject codeine into his muscles, Hughes had used glass syringes with metal needles that easily became detached.
God damn, that just gives me the fucking chills just hearing. That's fucking, oh God.
Hughes is buried next to his parents at Glenwood Cemetery in Houston. Approximately 3 weeks after his death, a handwritten will was found on the desk of an official of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Salt Lake City. The so-called, quote-unquote, Mormon will gave $1.56 billion to various charitable organizations, including $625 million to Howard Hughes Medical Institute, nearly $470 million to the upper management in Hughes companies and to his aides, and $156 million to his first cousin William Loomis, and $156 million split equally between his two ex-wives, Ella Rice and Jean Peters. A further $156 million was endowed to a gas station owner, Melvin Dummer, who told reporters that in 1967, he found a disheveled and dirty man lying along U.S. Route 95, just 150 miles north of Las Vegas. The man asked for a ride to Vegas, dropping him off at the Sands Hotel. Dummer said that the man had told him that he was Hughes. Dummer later claimed that days after Hughes' death, a mysterious man appeared at his gas station, leaving an envelope containing the will on his desk. Unsure if the will was genuine and unsure what to do, Dummer left the will at the LDS Church office. In 1978, a Nevada court ruled the Mormon will a forgery, and officials had died intestate without a valid will. Dummer's story was later adapted into a Jonathan Demme film, Melvin and Howard, in 1980. Hughes' $2.5 billion estate was eventually split in 1983 among 22 cousins, including William Loomis, who serves as a trustee of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute.
Is he Loomis Fargo Loomis?
I'm not sure. Possibly, since he's related to all these people. Doesn't appear to have an article.
His fingernails were not long enough to get into the articles.
Yeah.
Big pussy fingers, we used to call them.
You really got to be gooning it up to get in these articles.
He's got hairdresser fingernails. The Supreme Court of the United States ruled that Hughes Aircraft was owned by the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, which sold it to General Motors in 1985 for $5.2 billion. The court rejected suits by the states of California and Texas that claimed they were owed inheritance. In 1984, Hughes' estate paid an undisclosed amount to Terry Moore, who claimed she and Hughes had secretly married on a yacht in international waters off Mexico in 1949 and never divorced.
Yeah.
Moore never produced a proof of a marriage, but her book, The Beauty and the Billionaire, became a bestseller.
Of course, Eric, you gotta write a book.
You know, Howard, he was so great with the way that he would just sit around naked all day and just whine about wanting to watch a movie, terrible movie.
You ever see a man who could scratch his own balls while holding his hand 3 feet above?
he loved napkins. He loved napkins, you know, holding things with napkins, covering his genitals with napkins. He loved every aspect of them.
Yeah. An extensive napkin collection.
But that, boys,
is that it?
Is a story of the personal life of one Howard Hughes.
By the way, once again, proof that all the money in the world is a curse.
That and OCD.
Yeah.
Undiagnosed mental illness.
Because if you have mental illness like that from crashes and all that stuff, and you're rich, right, especially then.
You can just buy hotels and be like, this is mine now.
If you were even sane enough that you could make like a couple like lucid decisions, I mean, why would anyone ever question you?
Oh, no, especially not back in the 40s and the 50s. No. Yeah.
No, they would just be like,
oh, no, he's just a little off. He's fine.
Don't upset Mr. Hughes.
Nowadays, we'd call him autistic nowadays. He's on the spectrum.
You mean like they say about Elon?
Yeah.
Elon, like, invented the spectrum, okay? That dude is, like, he's so far gone. You know.
Well, there's that one clip that's been going around of, like, when, I think it was his last day, where he's just, like, he's in his own, like, world of drug-infused whatever he's in.
Ketamine bliss.
Ketamine. Yeah. It's called the K-hole he's been in.
Just stuck in the K-hole again.
He just starts dancing like a wook in the middle of the office.
That's a great song. And when he finally comes out of the fucking K-hole,
no
he's
effects,
gonna wake
man.
Up and be like, wait a minute, I did what?
Kids of the K-hole. No effects. Great song. Alright.
Ryan, he's never coming out of that.
We gotta go.